Hello everyone and welcome to Bags of Ethics Leading, our series bringing together experts in all things impacting people and planet. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Beth Knight, who has been working in sustainability as a business leader and educator for nearly 20 years. You're currently the head tutor at the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership course on business sustainability management. You've led wide-ranging sustainability and community investment work and transformation work at Amazon, at EY. You're the board chair of Save the Children on their corporate advisory board, and you're advising sustainable tourism for the Department for Culture, Media and Sport here in the UK. You've got countless awards, and you were one of my favourite tutors on the CISL course, and it's an absolute pleasure to invite you here today.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
So, Beth, today's topic is about labels, eco-labels. And so when I look inside my dress or my T-shirt or my bag, I can often see stitched inside the hem a sort of label which may have wash care instructions or the country of origin in which that item has been made. But over the past decade or so, we've been seeing more symbols coming on to labels around sustainability. So eco-labels, let's call it. And today is about you as an expert demystifying for all of us, consumers, businesses, on the different types of labels and how to really understand more about them. So the first point of call is, what is an eco label and why is it attached to products?
Yeah, eco labels were created essentially to try and simplify what is quite complex supply chains in both fashion and foods, which is where you'll primarily find them. And in Western markets, there's over 42 different kind of eco-labeling sustainability certifications that, depending on what sector you're working in, you could kind of lean into and acquire. Examples that people may be familiar with, so there's things like Fair Trade, there's the European Union Eco-Label. If you're working in fishing and fish, there's the Marine Stewardship Council. Certifications around bee-friendly farming, certifications around wildlife-friendly, predator-friendly, Rainforest Alliance, bird-friendly certifications, like you name it, there seems to be some form of eco-labeling around a product. And sometimes businesses are using this to validate and assure that their supply chain is doing the right things. Sometimes they're using that to make it simpler for the consumer, because an everyday buyer, everyday consumer, isn't going to have the capacity to go deep on every aspect of a product's supply chain. And you trust that there's a certain amount of diligence in how these companies are approaching their sustainability practices. So they've sort of ballooned in the kind of common product development approach. Rightly or wrongly, unfortunately, my view would be that we've tipped perhaps too far now into having quite significant confusion as a result of that, because there are so many, and you're not always clear which is the right one, what are the issues that you should be engaging with, concerned about, etc. There's also something called greenwashing, which can be quite prevalent, which is where an organization, a brand might be using an eco label to show that they are very sustainable, very socially and environmentally minded, but there might be things happening in other parts of their business that are not as green or eco as it purports to be.
Yeah.
And so it's not an easy thing to navigate by any
means. A really, really tricky alphabet soup of labels out there, from GOTS to BCI to GRS to, you know, all of them have acronyms, and it's really difficult to navigate. Can talk a few, if we can list a few of the names of commonly used eco-labels and textiles. And
then this is if anyone's listening and you have more, let's build that list. But we've got GOTS, BCI, GRS, Soul Association, Fair Trade is the popular one a lot of people know. SEDEX, I think, is another one. There's it, vast list, right? Any that you would add?
I mean, yeah, there's B Corp is one of my favorite ones to analyze at the moment, not specifically for textiles, but the challenge that I think retailers and brands have around is which ones do you pick, which ones do you back? Because for the consumer, just seeing any form of eco label might signal that it should be more expensive or it's better sourced. So, can you tell me more about when a brand has to apply to have the label? What are the sort of processes they go through to obtain them?
Yeah, so there's a difference between an eco label, which would be a very kind of linear assessment on a very specific aspect of an organization's supply chain, typically. And then there's other kind of certifications or accreditations that brands can get. A benefit corporation I'm a big fan of as well. I like that B Corp approach. That's a very holistic kind of end-to-end way of structuring a company, the governance that goes around it, highly credible, also very difficult to get because you have to go through quite a rigorous impact assessment. I will always preference a B Corp product for that reason above anything else. If I've got the option to go for those sorts of products, I would. With eco labels, so if you think about how a supply chain works, you have a fashion product. So let's use the t-shirt example. Within that, you have lots of different raw materials. Things come from different places in the world. They have to travel to get from point A to point B and then into the hands of the buyers. And all the materials inside it will have been exposed to different things. So you might have an eco-labeling around plastic sourcing in that material. You might have it might be fair trade, which means that all the workers within that supply chain have been treated fairly. That's what it says on the tin. It might be that it's organic cotton. So if the company has done it well, they have looked at a materiality approach of that t-shirt and figured out in the construction of that t-shirt, in the production of that t-shirt, what are the things that we need to be worried about? Is it cotton? Is it water consumption? Is it plastics? Is it child labor in my supply chain? Like what is it? And then they have engaged with an eco label and with an organization that will examine, critique, authenticate and validate their approach to that. And that means engaging with those organizations. They will have experts who are specifically focused down on that aspect that you've selected. It often means either doing a very detailed kind of response and being very transparent about what your organization is doing. Or if you're leaning into what's called assurance or audit. Audit can be a scary word, but in this case, it's a good thing. They would actually have people from the eco label organization come and authenticate that it's not just what you're telling us, it's what you're showing us, and you can come and you can see and you can search. Now, sometimes this works really well. Sometimes it can go wrong. The biggest example where it's gone wrong, many of you in the fashion industry that are listening might remember what happened with Rana Plaza, where because there had been cuts in health and safety controls, because there hadn't been proper audits, or there had been corruption in the process of kind of authenticating how the products were being produced, the factories were not actually safe, and there was loss of life in that Rana Plaza incident, loss of livelihoods for all of the employers impacted by what happened, and a lot of fairly large brands involved who had been working and operating in that area, all of whom would have had things like eco-labeling, would have been having audits, they would have been thinking that they were doing the right thing, And it's unfortunately only when a crisis of that magnitude has happened that these companies are held to account, have to do better, have to be more rigorous. And off the back of that, there has been something called the Bangladesh Accord that got created. And that's a very good example of where organisations have come together and said, this hasn't been good enough, we need to do better. We're all going to kind of lean in and support one another, because this is an industry-wide issue. It's not just prevalent to one eco-labelling or one company's product. It impacts all of us.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, that an eco-label can often mask a lot more that might be going on, because it's very focused on one specific area of concern. So if it's, for example, the Soil Association, it's very concerned about the farming methods and the soil associated with the growth of that fiber, whether it's cotton or any other material, isn't it?
But I mean, the Soil Association is really strong. Like they are very technically strong, and you can see, like just even simple things like scrutinizing and looking at the senior team at these organizations and understanding their background and the technical strength that they bring into their work. And the Soil Association is an organization that welcomes their critics onto the board and into discussions, because they are coming at this with real kind of true intent and rigor in how they're approaching their work. And it's a journey. It's a journey.
It is a journey. And who pays and funds for the label?
Well, it varies. So sometimes it's a cost that is embedded within the product. So to your point around, does it make something more expensive for the consumer? So sometimes that cost gets borne forward in the cost of buying the product. Sometimes companies are engaging really cleverly with things like choice selection. So Sainsbury's is a good example of this in the UK. If you go into Sainsbury's and you buy a banana, every banana they sell is fair trade. There is no choice other than you're getting the banana and it's this cost and it's fair trade and it doesn't impact your price. And we've been really thoughtful and conscientious as a retailer about how we want to put our money where our mouth is and live those values. And so they were very savvy from a behavioral science perspective as a retailer on not only did they understand that the eco label was important, but they also know their customers well enough that that they simplified it down to the choice selection level for their customer
to being none. you either have this banana or you don't have a banana at all.
And make that choice, and that's fine, and we'll make sure, we'll monitor, ensure the price point is there for you as a customer.
And when we think about the funding of the label, often these are membership organizations which manufacturers and retailers have to sign up to and get and pay for, or how does it work?
Some of them exist as charities, so companies donate in as a means of like funding and supporting their work. So you might find fair trade as an example. Like you would have a retailer that would you'd have a brand, sorry, that would pay to be certified as fair trade. And there's teams that then manage that eco-labelling process. They do the assurance, they do the audit.
And so that's on the fair trade side, or on the brand side?
On the brand side, So they bear that cost to show that they are in fact fair trade. But also it's a bit more complicated than that, because what you also see is the good eco-labels are not there to judge. They're there to help. So what you find is that they also do projects within supply chains. So they will bring together groups. Sometimes that's funders. Sometimes that's retailers. It could be institutional investors, high net worth individuals, whatever. Anyone who has a care sees the commercial priority in ensuring that these products are kind of ethically produced. And then these organisations have got projects and programmes within the supply chain to help farmers on the ground, to engage and tackle things like child labour and child slavery, which unfortunately is still extremely high in this world, much higher than it should be. Well, it shouldn't exist at all. Let me be very clear about that.
Yes.
And then, that's sort of how it gets ingrained down. The coffee supply chain, I know it's not a fashion example, but it's one that there is a huge amount of like projects and initiatives within the coffee supply chain, also because it's linked to addressing crime as well and kind of gangs working within and around parts of the coffee supply chain.
So do the farmers of on the farm, so cotton or coffee or chocolate or cocoa or banana farms, do they have to apply to be members? How are they found to be, you know, part of the fair trade labeling organization?
Yeah, so that I need to be really careful about what I say here, but these organizations do not want the people at the base of the pyramid impacted by how they're applying these kind of cost structures to the labeling process.
Yes.
So if they're doing this right and doing this well, it's not the farmer that's earning the smallest amount on the production of the goods. You know, that they are earning the smallest margin within that supply chain. So the cost point for those eco-labelling is typically happening at the brand end of the supply chain, and or within retailers or consumers that are approaching this with more of a kind of social impact or environmental kind of causal lens. Mm-hmm. I think that is truthful to say that. It's a sweeping statement, and it might not be the case in all eco-labels. So, yeah. And that there has been some examples in the media where journalists have gone in to scrutinise that kind of downward flow of money into supply chains and how and if that wealth that is being generated in that kind of production life cycle is trickling down enough to the base of the supply chain, i.e. whether workers are being paid what they should, if farmers are earning what they should. And with climate change as well, some of these farmers are having to actually even just change their whole production and what materials they're producing. There was quite a famous case study a few years ago where Oxfam, Barclays and a few others were working on how climate change was impacting hemp and thistle production and trying to move farmers off one set of one form of agriculture onto another because they could see that rising levels of drought, etc., were affecting crops that they had been producing for generations, which were no longer viable. And so when you're engaging at that level of complexity in the supply chain, you also have to ensure that there's the demand there for thistle. You know,
yes,
the average
exactly.
consumer doesn't necessarily know that they have a hemp bit of raw material in their product.
Yes.
So it's a tricky one.
I mean, so just focusing now on the supply chain, it's perfect. So if we break down what a supply chain is, you've got the farmer on one extreme of the supply chain of a natural product, naturally based product, if we want to call it. Then you have a manufacturer who converts what the farmer has made into, say, a thread that's then woven into a fabric, and then that fabric goes into another factory, which is then converted into a T-shirt or a bag or a pair of trousers, and then it's put on a ship or an airplane and then shipped all over the world, labeled up and sitting in shops across the world. Now, that's a very simplistic form of a supply chain, and often people have hundreds and hundreds of people involved in just the production of one garment. But if we focus on these labels and how they work across the supply chain, so they're intending to support the very top of the supply chain, i.e. the farmer. Does the farmer have to be involved in any, how does the farmer know about these sort of labels? How do they know, oh yes, I should know about fair trade, and I should try and be part of this GOTS thing? How does the farmer actually know? Or do these organizations request membership payments from these farmers? How does it work?
Well, we should ask them firstly, and yes. I'm sure their journey to this is different depending on what part of the world they're in or what aspect of agriculture. But I think typically they are selling their product, their raw material to a manufacturer, in your example. That manufacturer will be asking them questions, you know. They will be wanting to make sure that the raw material they're receiving is good quality. They'll be wanting to kind of scrutinize and engage with it. And so it's more than likely that that's the individual that they engage with the most, or the entity they engage with the most. You also see examples where these eco-labels in the process of doing audits and assurance will actually be boots on the ground in these communities, discussing, talking to them, educating them. And depending on like the base level of education that an individual might have, you know, if you're talking to a farmer in a Western economy who's gone to school, who can read, it's a very, you know, who can have access to the internet, who can self-educate, they might be moving quite quickly. They might be self-certifying on eco-labeling, etc. If you have a farmer that is illiterate or is, you know, up in the morning before the sun even rises, crashing out at night, has their children working in the fields with them, whatever it might be, they do not have capacity to like educate themselves in the nuanced kind of level of detail that these sort of assurance practices have. And so this is where the education role becomes very important. This is where the role of non-government organisations, charities, etc., help and provide that support that is required.
I think what you've just highlighted is really important, because when we wear a t-shirt, we absolutely, as consumers, may not have the ability to know about every single aspect of the supply chain. And that farmer has made a decision on what crop they want to farm on their particular land based on their climate, their soil, the access to seeds that they may have. And if our demand or if our tastes change, we might not realize that our taste change has a critical impact on that farmer, on their demand for their crop. So, for example, it could be really trendy one year to have pomegranate juice, and then the next year the fad is all about avocados or something else. And so as a consumer, and knowing about every component of the supply chain, whether it's certified or not and labeled or not, is actually very important. So do you feel, to ask you bluntly, that eco-labels are helpful for consumers in making their decisions on products?
I think there are a small percentage of consumers. 4 years ago, the statistic was 15% of Western consumers would make a different purchasing decision based on an eco-label. Or they would say they would, and then would the price and the cost of the item would maybe outweigh an eco-label. It's becoming more fashionable to be eco-conscious, so that behaviour is improving. But we are complex human beings. You know, ultimately, one of the biggest kind of industries that is emitting carbon right now is the fashion industry, right? So the waste that we see in textiles, the impact of fast fashion, there could be an argument made of buy less, buy more expensive and buy higher quality items versus volume at cheaper price. And so all of that kind of complexity in the psychology of what we buy, why we buy, is important. Some consumers need choice selection. Some consumers some consumers want choice, but a choice of three is enough. And then even where you have product placement on a website or an e-commerce platform or a shop shelf, it impacts what they'll buy. At a really simple level. So even like I'm 5'4", I'm quite pocket sized, right? And so you go into Oliver Bonas in a Liverpool Street station in London, I can't reach the stuff at the top of the bloody racks. So, you know, and that impacts, you know, what I engage with in the shop. So it's why you see not just the kind of technical data-driven assurance work happening on these eco-labels. You also have behavioural scientists working with consumer goods companies. You have really turned on, wise, savvy leaders like yourself who are educating themselves so that they can know and understand how to engage with this. And some organisations are being fairly bold now and saying, well, actually, that eco-labelling was fine for a point in time, but the conversation's moved on now. And they're engaging with new technology advances and technology solutions as a means of cutting through on what is quite a kind of linear chunk, you know, significant piece of work if you're doing a kind of end-to-end eco-labelling assessment. So I'm encouraged to see that with this kind of fast acceleration we're living through on technology, and I predict that we're going to see fewer variants in eco labels. We're sort of going through that adoption curve of, like, we've got a lot of them right now. Some will win out, some will drop out. Some the brands will select the ones that they think are most credible and right for them, and they'll start to use things like AI, the advent of digital product passports in the European Union, etc., is going to drive things in the right direction much more.
I think what's really exciting is talking about the digital product passport. So just to give viewers and listeners an understanding, what is a digital product passport and why do you think this is probably going to overtake many of the alphabet soup of eco-labels that we have? Why is it shown to be a bit more effective at showing the transparency across a supply chain?
It's simplifying the labelling, and it's putting the data at the fingertips of both the consumer and the retailers. So anyone listening to this, you can go online and give digital product passports a quick Google, but essentially imagine a QR code that someone can scan, and it will bring up a load of information about everything within that product's history, life cycle, anything in their supply chain, real-time information, not point-in-time information, but as stuff is changing within that supply chain for that product. And it will empower you to know with true credibility that something is what it says it is and is operating in the way it should be. And it's it's an early stage technology. It's kind of moving at pace, and there's some fun incubators out there. There's one called Islando, which is part of the Carbon 13 incubator group at the University of Cambridge, to try and help accelerate kind of best behaviours, to be honest, in how these products are coming to market. And how they're being valued.
I think what's interesting about the digital product passport, I mean, we at Bags of Ethics and Supreme have already implemented it in our labels and our bags and packaging. That's because we have the benefit of owning most of the supply chain. So we control most of the knowledge around it. But what's interesting is for the split between luxury goods and everyday consumer goods. And for the luxury sector, we've found that the digital product passport is a wonderful way of people showing if they want to resell their handbag, expensive handbag, designer handbag, for example. It shows that it's an authenticated product from a luxury brand, who was the previous owner of it. And it's almost like a hereditary piece, as well as showing the supply chain piece. So it's really having some dual effects. But I do feel that the mass consumer items and the everyday items and the adoption of the digital product passport, certainly in the UK, may not be as quickly adopted as in the luxury sector, and then obviously certainly in the EU.
Yeah, and I guess there's an analogy there about, like, ego and eco, right? Like, if you're in the luxury sector, and, you know, your customers have got a certain level of wealth just to be able to purchase those things, or people are doing what I suggested, which is buying less but buying quality, and probably with a bit more kind of time and thought about their purchasing behaviours. And that's okay, you know. So when you think about how systems change happens with these sorts of things, you're introducing a new technology. There's an adoption curve that has to happen.
Yes.
Some people have to move first before mass market can
adopt,
catch
it
up and get ready for it. And because the European Union is pushing that regulation, I mean, the European Union is world leading in how it's approaching engaging with sustainability through policy, and good for them, because it's therefore raising that bar for countries all over the world in how they're thinking about and engaging with this, because, you know, most supply chains, particularly in fashion, are global these days. And so it's kind of, it's going to have a really good kind of ripple effect. It, you know, it might not happen overnight. I take that point. I think you're right. But change starts with each of us, I think, as consumers.
It does. It does. And I think we're going to sort of quickly wrap up into a quick fire round of definitions and dictionary definitions, just to help our listeners who will be everyday consumers as well as businesses. But what I think we need to focus on is that the consumers have the decision-making power, but often, unless a retailer or a brand puts in front of them proper choices, like the Sainsbury's Bananas choice, then it's very difficult for consumers to know what the pros and cons are. And I want to focus firstly on a particular issue around recycling and the pros and cons of it. So can you define what recycled means, firstly? And secondly, when someone sees that an item is able to be recycled or is made from recycled items, what are the sort of questions that they need to ask when they read that sort of label? So what is recycled, and what is a recycled item?
Yes, so recycled is good. You might hear reduce what you buy, reuse what you have, recycle. And recycle is basically taking one product or many products, pulling apart or taking it back to, let's say, a base level of raw materials that are the composite parts of that initial product, and then recycling, i.e. putting them back into the supply chain, maybe in a different form, a different life, in order to make better use of raw materials, not having to take everything out of the ground continuously. That's essentially what recycled means. Many of us have recycled bins that we put things into.
It's really shocking, isn't it? Only 7-9% of UK recycling actually gets recycled.
We need to do better in this country, for sure. Yeah. A big part of that is the complexity of our recycling infrastructure in this country.
Yes.
Without going into a whole conversation about whether things should be privatised or nationalised or whatever else. But I think that if we stick with fashion, taking stuff physically into a charity shop is a good thing. Re-gifting your clothing to others is a good thing. If you put your clothing into a clothes bin that you find outside shops or at the local recycling centre, sometimes those clothes are sent to different parts of the world. Mm. That's not great. You know, I've worked in Nairobi in Kenya, where large pallets of reused clothing from the West are brought in, left on the edge of the slum, and people are like,
there's clothes mountains. I want to focus on the recycled element, because I think there is some opaqueness around it, because we talked about the pyramid, the classic pyramid that you just talked about. So reducing your consumption habits is the best, reusing is better, and recycling is probably the least good out of the three. And is that based on energy consumption and the transportation required and the emissions involved in breaking down something that may have, you know, a single-use plastic bottle?
Recycling is a good thing, right? Like, if you've got the choice to buy a recycled product, that's good. Fully endorse that behaviour. I think that the cost of a recycled product is essentially, yes, there's the transport cost. yes, there's the cost of breaking down the product into those raw materials that are usable, etc. There's then the onward transportation to wherever that goes. Sometimes it can be more expensive to use recycled products than kind of base raw materials. And in some countries, they do not have the recycling infrastructure to enable that. And there's also kind of a conversation really to be had with the people that are procuring the recycled materials, because that demand will also mean that the infrastructure for the recycling itself will improve. So it's all sort of like demand-driven. If you think about kind of free market economics, that's sort of how it all fleshes out. But at the moment, we're sort of, we're at the mercy of the systems around us, like us as everyday consumers. Even me, you know, I'm a fairly educated consumer, but I struggle sometimes to find things that I kind of credibly know are truly recycled. You know, something might have an eco label, but only part of the material within it is recycled.
In our sector, we've seen that recycled plastic bottles has had its heyday, and a lot of concerns are around the validity of that item being truly recycled, or whether the production of the virgin plastic bottle and then being recycled and then created into a new material is now a cause for concern that we've seen. So.
Yeah, and there's conversations as well around, you know, do we just need to regulate some of this stuff? So
yes.
Glitter is a great example. So glitter is a microplastic, right? So if you make a bag or a t-shirt and you've got plastic glitter on it, there is no easy way to recycle glitter. And therefore what happens is microplastic gets into supply chains. You're eating a bit of fish, and the chances are any bit of fish you're putting in your body has some form of microplastic in it, because microplastics make their way into the ocean. So then the conversation is, should we just like stop using glitter? Like, should we just stop using it?
Well, it has to be banned, doesn't it?
And then behaviorally, you're like, oh, damn, I quite like a bit of glitter on my outfit. I quite like being a bit sparkly. I love rocking up at a festival with my glitter makeup on my face, or whatever else it might be. And so people are introducing biodegradable glitter, and like there's a whole kind of diversified product range now on glitter that is not a microplastic. But then it's not as durable. And so that impacts, if you want to put glitter on a t-shirt or a bag or whatever, that impacts the quality of the product, because the microplastic is more durable. So again, then you're like, right, okay, what do we do here? Do we just have to regulate, because behaviorally it's not changing fast enough? And they're the conversations that then happen at the intersection of kind of sector forums, what eco labels might kind of lobby for, and how brands and retailers engage with these things.
And finally, I just want to talk about compostable. So why are nature-based, sort of natural fibres rather, natural fibres almost like the holy grail compared to any human-made fibre? Or is that not true?
I think that's true. By and large, that's largely true. It's less energy to recycle it. The product goes back into the earth. The energy returns back into the system. It's not kind of sitting there, kind of nascent. It's just point blank better for the planet. You know, it's the simplest way of saying it. You know,
nature based materials make more sense.
Actually, it's quite often better for your skin. it's like conversations around food as well. Quite often the food that isn't overly processed food is the food that's the best for us. There's research at the moment around rising levels in diabetes, rising levels in autism, etc., all linked to food and diet, and fast food, etc., etc. And we've over-engineered the things we put on our body, what we put in our body, And we need to get better at that, all of us. And we need help. And one of the levers and ways to kind of help has been traditionally eco-labeling, because it serves as a kind of kite mark and certification. And we'll see. We will see what happens. I'm going to watch curiously to see how that's going to shift in the market with all these technology changes.
Yeah. Well, Beth, you've been such a delight to talk to. It's my personal privilege to speak to you as my previous tutor at CISL. And what you've done today is really unpick a lot of the complexities around eco-labels. You've talked about it being a double-edged sword. Perhaps we've got far too many eco-labels. And to simplify it through the digital product passport may be a really wonderful future horizon for us as consumers and as business leaders. So thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Take care, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.